Okay, good evening, everybody. Welcome back to Exploring the Lord of the Rings. I'm Corey Olson, the Tolkien Professor, back with you again, having returned from my awesome trip to England. London Moot was fantastic. I don't know if you guys, for those of you who follow me on Twitter, you'll see I was updating all weekend with both the awesome time we had on Friday and our literary tour of London that that Darren Gray led, and then, of course, on Saturday itself during the conference. It was a spectacular conference, one-day conference, but there was so much. Every single paper was really, really good. And there were lots of things. So Blue was saying you didn't see anything about live broadcasts. No, we weren't able to. We weren't able to get the to get video equipment up to actually broad. We were thinking, hoping of broadcasting some of them, but we weren't able to do that. Though Blue Wizard, I have to tell you, the one thing that the people over there in Europe were really hoping for was that maybe we could do a special broadcast. And we were thinking we'd have to do it at 9 a.m. England time, because then it would be, you know, sometime between 1 and 4 a.m. for everybody in America, right? Which is what they were kind of hoping for a little turnabout, since, of course, right now, as always, you know, it's 2:45 over there in the U.K. So, I mean, almost every conversation I had with people over there started with, yeah, so sorry, I'm never able to make any of your shows live. And I'm like, dude, it is not your fault. but anyway, no, it was great. I had a wonderful time meeting folks, and it was an excellent conference and everything. It was really, really great. So thanks for everybody who was able to come out to that. And for those of you who were not able to go, fear not, sooner or later, hopefully, we will come nearer to you with one of our regional moots as we continue to expand our regional moot program. Speaking of which, we have an official announcement of for our next moot. So we have the next regional moot is going to be in a little bit, because coming up soonest now, actually, is Myth Moot at the end of June. So that's, again, the 21st to the 24th of June. But the next regional moot is going to be in Northern California. We have Bay Moot. That's going to be based in Oakland, actually. But right there in the San Francisco area. So that's going to be really, really cool. I've been wanting to get out to California for regional events for a while, and we're going to do two of them this year. This one, Bay Moot in Northern California, and we're going to do a Southern California one as well. But Bay Moot is official. Registration is open, and you can see the details on the theme of the conference and the call for papers and everything. So that's going to be really cool. So we have that. The date on that is August 18th. So August 18th, 2018, Bay Moot in the San Francisco Bay Area in Northern California is now officially open for registration. So if you're anywhere around that area, love to see you come out to Bay Moot. Okay. And also, for those of you who have been asking about the schedule for Myth Moot, it is coming soon. They're finalizing this. Okay, well, hang on. I say finalizing. They are finishing up the current draft of the schedule. For any of you who have ever organized events before, you know that, you know, schedules are always subject to change, and especially a long and complicated event like Myth Moot, the schedule is always very subject to change, and there are lots of changes well in advance and at the last second. Some people I know have been in touch with us and been asking questions like, you know, can you send me the schedule so that I know which days to attend? I'd be really careful about that, because we don't really know for sure. We can't promise we're going to be sticking to the exact daily schedule that we have, because there will have to be some changes. There always are. But anyway, just for you to be able to see exactly how much awesomeness is going to be, to get a glimpse of the levels of awesomeness that will be occurring at Myth Moot this year, the schedule will be out soon. So anyway, so that's the goal. So yeah, JJ says just attend all of them. That's pretty much the recommended strategy, really. Okay. So, anyway, so that's So Mythmoot in June, schedule coming out soon. Baymoot in August, official and ready for registration. Coming up soon after that, we have the Southern California Moot that I mentioned. We don't have an official date for that one yet, but we're looking at October. Late October, we're having Middle Moot, which was in Iowa last year and is going to be shifting down to Kansas City this year. So that will be hopefully in the beginning of October. So we're Charlotte, as I mentioned, North Carolina, and there are other things that we're working on. We're still working on Denver. We're working on Seattle. And of course, Tex Moot will be coming up again beginning of the year. So we have a lot of really fun and exciting opportunities for moots. Like I said, if you're not able to make, I'm not trying to make people needlessly jealous. In fact, remember, the regional moots are, part of the motivation for that is, lots of people have always been, whenever I talk about Mythmoot every year, people are like, oh man, I wish I could make it over there, but I can't travel so far. Like, I get it. Not everybody can travel that far, right? It's often hard to, get the time free and make the journey. But, so we're coming to you, right? Not to everybody's door. We can't have one in every state and in every town. But we're trying to hit, major regions where we can be as close as we can to as many people as we can. So that's the plan. Okay, so, we're having Twitch audio problems? Oh, dear. Huh. That's a little strange. Can people hear me? You guys hear me on Twitch all right? Yeah? It looks like it's okay. My software seemed to suggest it's all right. No? Okay. Discord is good? Okay. And Twitch is good? Okay, good. Looks like everything's fine. Sometimes people report a problem and it's hard to tell at first whether it's the person or somebody else. So, okay, cool. Well, I'm sure we'll work through it. Okay. Anyway, so thanks very much for everybody who participated in London Moot. New events coming up. It's going to be awesome. One thing I wanted to sort of apologize or sort of explain / apologize for in advance. So, okay. I have somewhere on my homeward journey, I seem to have slightly injured my back a little bit. And for those of you who are old, crusty people like me, know kind of what that's like. So if I seem to be kind of straight or rigid or talking funny at any point here tonight, it's because I'm dealing with like some strange back pain and have myself propped up in unusual ways and can't like breathe deeply or else it hurts. So just, again, bear with me. If it gets too painful to listen to me, let me know. But I should be able to make that. Also, I will probably be making fewer hand gestures than usual, as waving my right arm around is a little painful. So anyhow, it's all good. So yeah, I'm fine as long as I don't really move or breathe very much. So it's all good. Yeah. Tim is suspecting I was captured and tortured while in England. It is so not true. So not true. Anyway, yeah. Okay. So, like I say, I know that I appreciate being around other old folks like me who understand about this kind of thing. I was just earlier this evening surrounded by teenagers who are all giving me these vague and pitying looks. And I'm like, you just wait. You just wait. Someday you'll get it. All right. Okay. So, let us get back to the text because 2 weeks ago, we were right in the middle of Butterbur's letter. So, Mad Violinist, not very bendable, is exactly what I am tonight. I'm really feeling the parallel there. Okay, all right. So tonight we're looking at the title of tonight's class is The Truth Will Out, because of course finally things are the revelations about Aragorn and his true nature and his true name of course finally come out after at the end of this long conversation that we've been looking at now for several weeks between primarily Aragorn and Frodo, though of course we've been looking at Butterbur's interjection for the last couple weeks. So, But first, so since we've been out for 2 weeks, there have been a bunch of posts on the discussion board. I thought rather than trying to quote many of them at length, I just wanted to kind of touch on a few points from a few of them. So I just have a couple notes here today. Yardsard wanted me to talk about the phrase, but can I just say, by the way, I love the fact that somebody's complaining about the fact that I skipped something. Like, there was a phrase in one sentence I didn't talk about. So I was like, hey, come on, can we go back to that, please? Let's not skip over that. So fine. Let's do that. And that is that I didn't comment on Aragorn's insult to Butterbur, who only remembers his own name because people shouted at him all day. What's up with that? How do we understand that? And the main thing that JJ, please don't make me laugh. That is absolutely the worst. The only thing that could be worse than laughing would be sneezing. I really hope I don't sneeze or I might end up on the floor. So we'll see what we can do. Anyway, So Yardsard was concerned. Basically, the sort of initial reading of this was that Aragorn was accusing Butterbur of being stupid, which, of course, among other things, apart from being rude, is also in contradiction, of course, to what Gandalf says about Butterbur later on. That he can see through a brick wall in time. So, when he tells Frodo that, he doesn't know the Brelanders very well if he thinks that old Barlaman is stupid. My point here is that I don't think that this is an insult about stupidity. This is not about intelligence. Remember the context. This is, first of all, the first sentence that Aragorn says when he steps out of the shadows, right? In response to Butterbur saying, you may know your own business, but if I were you, I wouldn't take up with a ranger, right? And Aragorn says, and who would you take up with? A fat innkeeper who only remembers his own name because people shouted at him all day. So now, he's not saying a fat, stupid innkeeper. I mean, that would be one way to kind of summarize it, but I don't think that it's accurate. He is not maligning Butterbur's intelligence here. He is bringing up his forgetfulness, which, remember, he's like, so it's his forgetfulness that he's talking about, and which Butterbur himself has just confessed, right? So Butterbur has come in and confessed that he had this letter, that Gandalf asked him to give it to him, and that he forgot, right? He forgot to send it along. Aragorn is making a contrast, right? An unflattering contrast. Let me not make that hand gesture. He is making an unflattering contrast, right, between himself and Butterbur, right? And again, I think that what he's kind of criticizing him with here, right? What he's jibing him with, again, is not like, you're so dumb, but rather, look, how much help are you, right? Look, you're so forgetful. You didn't even, you were given one job, Butterbur, one job to send this letter to Frodo, and you couldn't do it, right? You forgot about it. And so he's emphasizing that. He's exaggerating the forgetfulness of Butterbur. You only even remember your own name because people shouted at you all day, right? So again, it's not the general intellect, I think, of Butterbur that is under assault here. It is his incompetence, right? Like, fine assistant to Gandalf he has shown himself to be, right? Remembering the context, that's, I think, definitely how I understand that. And he is, Mariel, I think he is a little tetchy, right? And you know, one of the things that I'm almost wondering here, when you look back on this scene, none of the good guys, even Aragorn, has really covered themselves with glory, right? I mean, we've been talking about what a really quite bad job Frodo has been doing of being on the lam. We, of course, are just now talking about how Butterbur has not impressed anybody, right, with his ability to help Gandalf or to help Frodo. But Strider also, right? He did, you know, no, Butterbur wouldn't, you know, was not going to let him come in. But seriously, like, there was nothing else he could do. He failed to prevent the thing that happened in the common room, right? He surely there must be a part of Aragorn that's thinking, you know, maybe I could have played this differently, right? Maybe I could have found some way to step in a little bit sooner, and could have done something a little bit more. So I'm wondering even if there's a little bit if that might perhaps even sort of the knowledge that even he himself has not perhaps done perfectly well might also be kind of sharpening his irritation to some extent. Now, JJ, you're right. I mean, I'm not saying that I necessarily think that breaking into their room by force, you know, overpowering Butterbur and forcing his way into their room would have necessarily been, you know, the straight path to their hearts and trust. I agree with that. But he's had opportunities, right? He could have spoken to them outside the town, right? He could have spoken to them before they got to the inn. He's had chances, right? He could have initiated conversation with Frodo significantly earlier, right? Before Pippin built up his head of steam, right? I mean, I gotta think that there are a few other options that he could have taken. Again, I'm not saying that he necessarily just forces his way past Butterbur, but again, I don't think it necessarily had to have come to that. But anyhow, okay. So that's just to say, so my main point there is I certainly don't think that he is accusing, Butterbur simply of being stupid, but at the same time, as we talked about a little bit last time, I think that although he speaks insultingly to Butterbur, I think that we do still, I don't think he means it all the way. I mean, it's not totally different from the way that friends talk to each other. And I know that he and Butterbur are not really friends. Certainly not, you know, companions and joking around with each other like we see the hobbits do all the time. But yet still, I think that there's something in this kind of insulting language that I think is sort of less abrasive in this particular social context than it might perhaps seem to us. But anyway, okay. But this leads me to Marielle's question, which was, you know, does Aragorn know that his kin are dead? She was thinking about the scene when Aragorn is reflecting on the Nazgul and about how terrible the Nazgul are and everything, and how we were reflecting that this seems to be him remembering some kind of very painful personal encounter with the Nazgul. And she's wondering if this might also perhaps be some reflection on the fact that those same Nazgul have probably recently killed several of his kin. Marielle was pointing out that if we look in Appendix B in the Tale of Years, it was only less than a week ago, that is before this scene, that the Black Riders came and scattered the Dúnedain that were guarding the Shire. So there's already been a confrontation between the Rangers, which are you know, sort of the external bounders, right? You've got the Shire bounders, but you've got the Rangers outside them keeping off the really dangerous things, and that they have been scattered by the Black Riders when the Black Riders come in. And Mario was saying, presumably, you know, many of them must have been killed during these confrontations, and that perhaps that's one of the things that he's reflecting on. Would he even know, she was asking? You know, would news have reached him yet? I would think yes. So as far as that specific question is concerned, do I think that he would know about it if it had happened? Yes, I do think he would know about it if it had happened. Let me explain the reason why I think that. It's been days, right? I mean, it's been long enough for, even if he was not there, it's been long enough for word to get through to him. And he's obviously around Bree here, and around the main road. I don't think to the other Dúnedain, he would be impossible to find. So someone surely must have come and told him. He knows all about the movements of the Riders. Presumably he knows that they've been in conflict, with the Dúnedain already. So I'm thinking he's got to know that it's happened. So Marielle, I think that is a perfectly valid thing, for us to be thinking about. Now it's a little tricky, right? Because that detail, of the confrontation between the Nazgul and the Rangers guarding the edges of the Shire wasn't written at the time that Tolkien wrote this scene, right? And I don't even mean the earlier version when it was still Trotter the Hobbit with the wooden shoes, who is having this conversation with Frodo. Even after it changes to Strider, the Ranger, he's still, even after his change to Trotter the Human Ranger, before it even eventually then finally changes to Strider, he's still... That concept is a late concept. A lot of those details in Appendix B are part of the sort of the later working out and ironing through of all the details. But that doesn't make it inaccurate, right? That doesn't make it inappropriate, I think. It's one of those things that Tolkien is really, really good at, is accommodating his story, accommodating the prose of his story to revisions, right? I mean, Tolkien is like the king of retcon. So I think that it does add a really interesting layer in that way to remember. And Darren had a really interesting post, which I commend to you, on the contrast between Aragorn and Gandalf's Bree Town strategies, how Aragorn is secretive and Gandalf brash in particular. He was contrasting, looking at some particular moments of contrast between how Aragorn is always popping in unexpectedly, right? And nobody sees him coming or going, and nobody really knows who he is. Apparently, nobody even knows his real name, right? What his right name is, I've never heard. So Aragorn has never, he's not even given a false name for himself, right? He is just content to be a completely nameless vagabond, right? Whom they've given a name, which he's adopted, right? So he is consent to go around saying, I am around here, I am called Strider, right? But even Butterbur, who has known him presumably for years on and off, right? Has not, like, Butterbur knows he has never even given a name for himself. And that's pretty secretive, right? So he is not only mysterious in the sense of nobody knows his business, nobody knows where he's coming from or where he's going, but he's also explicitly mysterious, right? Like, has never introduced himself anywhere. Yes, JJ, careful now. That was a little too funny. But yes, the Prancing Pony is like the anti-Cheers, where nobody knows his name. Yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. No humor. No humor. Anyway, right. Yeah. And Mario, I agree. I mean, how sketchy is that, right? Like, to never even have given... I mean, he could at least have given a fake name, right? So his approach has been to be the super secretive man of mystery, whereas Gandalf is very open, right? Despite the fact that obviously traveling conjurers and whatnot are not looked upon kindly, that they don't like uncanny things in Bree. Everybody knows that Gandalf is a wizard, right? And Butterbur is willing to vouch for him openly, even though he obviously acknowledges, Butterbur, that there are many people that are not going to think kindly of a wizard, right? And yet Butterbur is willing to say that he's a friend of mine, whether or no. But nevertheless, that still shows you how open. Okay, so Gandalf, not only in using his right name, or at least the right name by which he is known in that region, but he is very open. And Darren was even contrasting their particular approaches with Butterbur, right? How, you know, Strider is like off in dark corners of the common room, and you don't see him come and you don't see him go. Whereas Gandalf will walk right into Butterbur's private room without knocking, right? Ask him to do a favor for them. It's pretty cool. I think that's a really good distinction between the two of them. I think that, you know, Darren makes a really good contrast between the two of them. And I agree with Darren that there's not much. You can see why Butterbur has such a very different relationship with the two of them, right? You can tell which one sort of fits Butterbur better and which kind of approach he's more comfortable with, right? Yeah, so I thought that that was a really great contrast. And thanks again, Darren. Darren made this post on the discussion board on Thursday, the day I was flying over to London for his conference. Darren did such an awesome job organizing London Moot. It was great. And gave a great paper, too. Gave a paper which a lot of you would be really interested in. He was talking about adaptation of narrative into gameplay and some of the challenges of gameplay mechanics and the way that those are often in tension with storytelling over the course of games. And I thought that was it was a really thoughtful and interesting talk. He was asked, this is the one I tweeted this. Someone asked him what he suggested they could do to improve Shadows of Mordor, and his answer was chuck it in the bin. I was like, oh, see, there you go. Tough but fair. Anyway, cool. All right. So I will, let's move on. Let's move on. Okay. So let's go back to the letter. So we were, I put the body of the letter up again because I wanted to just kind of read through the letter again briefly. It's been 2 weeks. So I want to read through the letter again briefly. And then just remember the frame of mind of Gandalf. Yours in haste is sort of, I think, the theme of this letter, right? And I think that we can see, as we were talking about at the end of class last time, some places in which Gandalf is clearly in haste as he's writing, right? Dear Frodo, bad news has reached me here. I must go off at once. You had better leave Bag End soon and get out of the Shire before the end of July at latest. I will return as soon as I can, and I will follow you if I find that you are gone. Leave a message for me here if you pass through Bree. You can trust the landlord, Butterbur. You may meet a friend of mine on the road, a man, lean, dark, tall, by some called Strider. He knows our business and will help you. Make for Rivendell. There I hope we may meet again. If I do not come, Elrond will advise you. And JJ, I agree. This is a significant step up from push along. Yeah, exactly, which was what he was saying in the very first draft of this letter. Yeah. Okay. Yours in haste, Gandalf. Now, we'll go to the postscripts. P.S. Do not use it again, not for any reason whatever. Do not travel by night. Okay. So, yeah, interesting. Mariel is pointing out the, she loves the, if you pass through Bree, right? As if there's much chance of their not passing through Bree. In fact, Mariel, what's really funny about that in retrospect is that for them not to pass through Bree, they would have to be being very stealthy, right? It's almost like Gandalf is giving them way too much credit for being stealthy and managing to hide themselves successfully. Gandalf has a very cheerfully optimistic view of how Frodo's going to perform on the lam, right? Because maybe we should bypass the town and stay discreetly, in the woods and pass by so nobody knows we came through. Like that even occurred to them, right? Instead of coming in and going to the inn and hanging out in the common room with the company, right? Yeah. Yeah. Not too much hope of that. Yeah. Way too much credit. I agree, Lady Shmebiwak. Yeah, exactly, John. They could at least have stayed in Archit or something. There are lots of ways in which they could have perhaps tried to stay out of the spotlight just a little bit more. Yeah, Brunier, exactly. It never even occurred to him, apparently, to say, oh, yeah, P.S. Don't go to the common. Stay in your rooms if you're coming to the Prancing Pony, at least. Yeah. So back to his PS. Do not use it again, not for any reason whatever. Do not travel by night. Of course, we can see what this shows, right? This shows that he knows about the ringwraiths when he wrote this, right? So the instructions in the PS are plainly pointed. Well, in retrospect, that is from our point of view, knowing what we now know, it's very clear why he's written this, right? But because both of those two things are very specific Ringwraith-related advice, right? The Ringwraiths are stronger at night, and they're stronger at night and can you know sense you better in the night, and also, of course, they're going to be drawn to the ring if you use the ring. So this is a particularly sort of, frustrating, embarrassing sort of thing for Frodo to be reading. I mean, how many times has he used the ring? How many times has he put on the ring? I guess he's only actually put it on, is it just twice? Once at Tom Bombadil's house and then once in the common room? Yeah. Well, twice, almost two other times, right? But he's only actually put the ring on twice. But of course, you'll notice something else here is that he doesn't tell Frodo more. He, unlike Aragorn, seems to take the Gildor school of not telling Frodo more than he needs to know, lest terror keep him from his road, right? He doesn't give them any excuse for what he's talking about there, right? His exclamation points make it clear that he really means it, right? And that there is presumably some peculiar reason, you know, some very particular reason why he is urging this at this point. But it's not obvious, right? It's not clear. It's not explicit. He doesn't say someone is coming after you, right? And I think, remember, we talked about this last time as well. It's not Gandalf's itinerary here. He confidently believed he would be able to get back long before this. And also the Ringwraiths were still far away from the Shire. So knowing how much lead time he had, it makes a little bit of sense that he would not give them more, because why terrify Frodo into thinking they're already at his doorstep? They weren't at his doorstep. And had he left before the end of July, he would never have come anywhere close to them. But he knows they're in the area. So him making these injunctions, I think, is not necessarily sort of foretelling Finn, but is instead just kind of better safe than sorry. Right. And the don't travel by night is important because it's counterintuitive. Even if you are doing a good job of, you know, being on the run, it might occur to you to say, like, well, in order to keep a low profile, let's travel by night. Right. Exactly as Frodo did do at the beginning. Right. Anyway. Yeah. He is being evasive, Marielle, and I do suspect, as I believe you suggested earlier on, and as Aragorn was just suggesting, was he worried that the letter might be intercepted? He does not say much that is, I mean, we were noticing last time, he knows our business and will help you, right? We can see him being evasive, not only in a similar way to how Strider was being evasive, but even using the same evasive words, right? Business there, to talk about the quest of the ring. So I think that it's, and notice he doesn't say what the bad news is, right? Or exactly why he needs to get out of the Shire by the end of July at latest. Or why they will need help, or why they're going to Rivendell. I mean, no real details other than the fact that Frodo's leaving and that he's going to Rivendell are mentioned here, right? So, yes, it does seem that he is not willing to trust too much to writing, but I don't think that's the P.S., his lack of alluding to the Black Rider specifically there, or really saying anything about Pursuit at all, or, you know, why he's giving that those particular pieces of advice. I think that that's less about the interception of the letter and more about not wanting to freak Frodo out over much, which, again, I think would have been overkill had Frodo received the letter in July. Okay. Yeah, good. All right, cool. Let's look at the PPS. And by the way, even just the number of postscripts itself suggests that he was writing in haste, right? He finished his letter, and then he's like, oh, wait, hang on. Let me make sure to tell him to not travel by night, and whatever he does, not to use it again, right? And then he's like, oh, yeah. So I gave the description, right, which, again, as Erokeb is pointing out, perhaps not the most perfectly illuminating, or it's not going to necessarily limit it to, you know, narrow it down too very much, right? To call him lean, dark, and tall by some called Strider. And now the name, of course, will help. But still, they're not going to really know him if they meet him on the road just by calling him lean, dark, and tall. So he's like, oh, yeah, they better make sure it's the real Strider, right? Make sure that it's the real Strider. There are many strange men on the roads. His true name is Aragorn. All that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes a fire shall be woken. A light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king. Okay. Mad Violinist, that description of a Strider is very similar in kind to the perky chap with the bright eye description that he gives of Frodo. Exactly. Okay. So he gives two pieces of information here, right? Make sure that it's the real... Okay, he gives a piece of advice, right? Make sure that it's the real Strider. Don't go being gullible and taking up with the first stranger you meet, thinking that it's, you know, this is the guy I'm telling you about. And he gives him two pieces of information, right? His true name is Aragorn. And then he just quotes the poem, right? Now, here again, I think we can see significantly that Gandalf is in haste, right? He is not in too much haste to write the entire poem out, but he is to explain it. Why did he write the whole poem? I mean, it is a short poem. I agree, Brunir. It is a short poem. The function of this poem, in retrospect, is clear, right? Aragorn's going to quote a line from it in a minute, and that will be a confirmation, right? If he knows this poem, right? This poem proves his identity. The knowledge of this poem proves his identity. But Gandalf hasn't even given any instructions about that. He just randomly puts this poem in. His true name is Aragorn. All that is gold is not glitter, not all those who wander are lost, right? Okay. So had Frodo been given a little bit more information, maybe he would know to ask Strider, you know, is there a poem, you know, like associated with you in some way? Or are there some verses that I might want to hear right now? Right. I mean, he could find some way, to ask this as a kind of password. Right. But JJ, I agree with you too. I also think he hasn't given those instructions, and perhaps Gandalf thinks it doesn't need it, right? Because let's look at the poem. All right. What does the poem say? All that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. Now, one thing we can see, this poem is 8 lines long, right? And it's divided into two halves syntactically, right? We've got a period at the end of line 4 and another period at the end of line 8, right? So we have two sentences in this poem. You always have to pay attention to syntax. This is one of my big pet peeves, right? Lots of people just sort of read the lines of a poem as if they were just like a random series of images. And I know that there's some modern poetry that's written like that. Tolkien's poetry is almost never like that. This is never just a bunch of images. This is a sentence, right? There are two things that are being said in this poem. So what's the first one? The first one is these four parallel clauses, right? Notice how, again, we have those, the punctuation at the end of the line, all of those lines are interesting, right? And we see the same pattern, comma, semicolon, comma, period. So those first four lines are associated together, but the semicolon breaks them down into two sets of two lines, right? All that is gold does not glitter, not all those who wander are lost, is the first pairing, right? And it's interesting that that's, because it's not paired by rhyme. Rhyming couplets is a thing that Tolkien does a lot. All of The Way of Lathian is written in rhyming couplets, but he doesn't use that here, right? So it's not rhyme that's connecting these together. Again, it's syntax. The semicolon tells us to group those two together and to separate them from the old that is strong does not wither, deep roots are not reached by the frost. Are you here in the rhythm of this, by the way? Notice anything interesting about this? What does this sound like or not sound like? But anyway, come back to that in a second. Those first two lines. Yes, Matt, great observation. We have the lines 3 and 4, especially, are both winter metaphors, right? The old that is strong does not wither. So this idea of like the old tree, which is not withering, deep roots are not reached by the frost, right? So you've got the thing that is strong enduring through winter, right? Through winter and through age. Fourth Dauntless, you're exactly right. This is not Hobbit meter. This is not the same meter that we've been seeing in most of the poems that we've been getting, the Hobbit poems that we've been getting, which are fairly dependable iambic tetrameter, right? Four-beat iambic lines, like the drinking song, like the walking song. This is not in that meter. Yeah, good. And you're exactly right, JJ. It is triplet notes. It's not iambic or... So we've had the iambic feel, right, of the Hobbit poetry. We've had the trochaic feel of the Tom Bombadil rhythm, right? Bombadil, Tom Bombadillo. We don't get either one of those here. We get that triplet feel. All that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. Bum, 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 bum. Yes, exactly. Anapest is what it is. That's the dominant rhythm of these lines. Anapest is quite unusual. Dr. Seuss loves anapest. Tolkien much more rarely uses anapest. The Sneetches, the Grinch, those are all in, anapestic tetrameter is one of Dr. Seuss's favorite meters. He does it wonderfully. Tolkien rarely uses anapest. Certainly this is the first, I'm pretty sure this is the first anapestic poem, that we have come across, in the Lord of the Rings. Okay. But I'm jumping all over the place here. Back to those winter images, right? So I agree that you know that old withering and the winter frost, right? And so both of them have that sense of waiting, right? Like the old thing which is lingering there, But if it's strong, it remains and it doesn't wither. Especially in the old that is strong does not wither, the immediate juxtaposition of the old that is strong not withering being juxtaposed to deep roots, right? Makes you think of an old, tough tree. Old tree roots are extremely strong, right? Are extremely tough, and they cling and they can't be uprooted, even if the tree itself looks dead, right? So yeah, the frost not able to reach the deep roots. The old that is strong lingers and doesn't wither. How about those first two lines? The first two lines are about things being different from what they appear, right? All that is gold does not glitter. Now notice this is Shakespeare reference. Anybody got the Shakespeare reference here? Or the near Shakespeare reference? That is a near quotation of a famous Shakespeare line. Anybody? Anybody with the Shakespeare? Not all those who wander are... Exactly, JJ, you got it. Oh, Valor even remembers this. Oh, wait, I think it's not Aragorn. I think it was Monaco. I think it was the Prince of Monaco, not the Prince of Aragon. But still, it was, yes, from The Merchant of Venice, of course. All that glitters is not gold is the line, is the Shakespeare line. Right. This is when you've got, you know, Portia with the three chests, and you've got to choose the correct casket. The gold casket. They each have a verse in them. And the first line of the one from, I believe it was the one that the Prince of Monaco, or the King of Morocco, rather. Opens, says, all that glitters is not gold. And that's the sort of the traditional moral, right? Beware of like shiny, attractive things because they might not truly be gold underneath, right? That's the message there. That's the take-home moral from that particular moment in The Merchant of Venice. The first line of Tolkien's verse here, which, so again, it's in that same position, reverses it, right? Instead of saying all that glitters is not gold, it says all that is gold doesn't glitter, right? Which is a similar moral, but it's not the same thing, right? Something might be gold, even though it might be fair, even if it looks foul, right? Which is not the same, importantly different from the moral that says, even if something looks fair, it might be foul underneath, right? All that is gold does not glitter. Not all those who wander are lost. Something might look kind of shabby, but be gold underneath, right? Somebody might wander around and look lost, but they're not really lost, right? So be careful not to judge things by their surface, is the message of those first two lines. The second two lines start talking about the inner nature of the thing, right? And also, so that's one thing. One fact is that things sometimes might be valuable underneath, valuable and purposeful underneath when they look purposeless and worthless on the surface. Second two lines, just because something's old doesn't mean it's weak. Just because roots, when they are deep, are not able to be reached by the frost. Even when a long winter sets in, the deep-rooted plants will still survive. So yes, I agree, Daniel. They do all deal with inner nature, right? The inner sort of the inner core of the thing. I agree. Let's keep going. The second half of the poem. From the ashes a fire shall be woken, a light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken, the crownless again shall be king. From the ashes a fire shall be woken, a light from the shadows shall spring. Renewed shall be blade that was broken, the crownless again shall be king. I love this poem so much. Okay. Notice first the tense change. Yes, Erokheb good. Erokheb says the first four lines are aphorisms and the last four lines are prophecy, right? Yes, there is a significant shift here, right? The first is kind of general advice, right? Keep this in mind, right? This is generally and specifically applicable, right? Here's wisdom for you in these first four lines. The last four lines are predictions. From the ashes of fire shall be woken. And we shift from the present tense to the future tense. A light from the shadow shall spring. Notice that we get the contrast, right? The contrast of the dead ashes and the wakening fire. We get the contrast of the shadows and the light, right? Like the, you know, we had, you know, the old and the strong, you know, the thing that is gold but not glittering. So again, we have a similar kind of theme, but it's not working the same way anymore, right? Now we're talking about things coming to new life. Out of the ashes, out of the dead ashes, will spring a fire. We have reversal. Normally, fire burns down into dead ashes, right? Old things wither, fires burn out and leave ashes behind them, right? But the prophecy is, we first said, it's not necessarily true that the old things wither and die, right? Sometimes they don't. And in the future, a flame is going to leap forth from the ashes, right? It's going to reverse. It's going to be a reversal of that sort of normal movement, right? And a light is going to spring forth out of the shadows. It's not going to be a light dying and then the shadows coming in, right? Like happens in the evening every day or something like that. No, this is going to be a light from the shadows shall spring. And yeah, fourth dauntless, I think it is significant that the fire isn't rekindled from the ashes, but spontaneously springs forth. The woken, from the ashes of fire shall be woken. Notice the other thing that's important here, not just the tense of the verb, what else has changed? What else has changed in, about the verb in that line? You notice? Which fourth dauntless, I think, speaks to your point. Notice I'm using my cup with my left hand today. I can't lift it with my right. Yes, exactly. Erokheb and JJ shifts to the passive voice. This is really important, right? Because what does the passive voice do? Exactly. Fareth of Extasia. Okay. Fareth, yes. It shall be woken. Someone will do the waking, and it doesn't say who, right? The passive voice sort of conceals the doer of the action. It puts the grammatical emphasis, right, the syntactic emphasis on the object of the action rather than on the one who does the action. And sometimes the doer of the action is completely absent from the sentence. That's the point of the passive voice, right? Notice we haven't used the passive voice. All that is gold does not glitter, and all those who wander are lost. The old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost. From the ashes of fire shall be woken. So forth, dauntless. Yes, it is true that this is not just, it's not just going to kind of happen, right? This is not just like the, eventually the ashes are going to be slowly, you know, like a flame is going to slowly arise someday. Right. No. Someone is going to wake up the fire, right, from the ashes. And a light from the shadows shall spring. The light is going to spring from the shadows, out of the shadows. Renewed shall be blade that was broken. The crownless again shall be king. Now, and that's really cool, too. The seventh line, right, is also passive. Renewed shall be blade that was broke. The blade shall be renewed by somebody, right? We don't know. Presumably, I'm going to bet the same person who woke the fire from the ashes, right? The fire shall be woken from the ashes. The blade shall be renewed. And we get the B repeated again in the last line, but that's not the passive voice. The crownless again shall be king. That's active voice. Who's going to be king? The crownless is going to be king, right? So the B that is used in that final line is like the culmination of things, right? And it kind of tells you who's going to do the awakening, who's going to do the renewing, right? Answer, the crownless again shall be king. Who's crownless? Yeah, like that gold one, the not glittery one, because he doesn't have a crown yet. Yeah, we're tying back to the beginning, right? The wandering one who isn't lost, the gold one that doesn't glitter, the crownless is going to be king. He's going to renew the blade that was broken. He is going to awake a fire from the ashes, and a light will spring forth from the shadows. That's pretty cool, right? And no, for Thoughtless, I think that when talking about renewing, renewed chubby blade that was broken, I don't think it's the smithcraft being alluded to there. I don't think that it's the hand of the smith that's as important as the hand of the smith is. I think it's still speaking of this, the crownless is going to be it's Aragorn who's going to renew the blade that was broken, right? Again, his hand won't be on the hammer, right? That does the reforging. But still, yeah. And yes, Matt, you're absolutely right. The relighting of the fire to forge the sword, it does anticipate that, right? From the ashes of fire shall be woken, which is both a metaphor for, sort of the new life, and fire that is going to be woken, you know, among the people in the land. But also, of course, it does anticipate the reforging of the blade, right? And yes, Tim Duff, that's a great point. He doesn't say reforged chubby blade that was broken. It says renewed. The blade will be renewed when it is wielded once again by the crownless, as it was wielded of old by the king, right? Yes, exactly. And Eroheb, absolutely. The flame of the West, which is what Endural is going to be called, right? Is again, that's also presumably has to do with the fire that is going to be woken from the ashes as well. And John, you're absolutely right. The emphasis on again in that last line, that's a really important word, right? The crownless again shall be king. This is not like a rebellion. We're not planning a coup here, right? That he who is now crownless will someday not be crownless anymore, right? I mean, that's true, but that's not the point, right? He will be king again, right? This is a restoration to a crown, not a unobtaining of a crown. Right. This is not a call to arms to revolt and put somebody new on the throne. And again, so just as from the ashes of fire shall be woken, or, you know, the crownless again shall be king, as I said at the end, refers back to the all that is gold and not does not glitter line. In that sense, the crownless again shall be king also brings together that idea of the old that is strong does not wither. Deep roots are not reached by the frost, right? Just as the deep roots promise that once the thaw finally comes, the plant will once again grow and bloom. So the crownless again shall be king. There's a lot in that last line that really sort of fulfills the promise of those first four lines, right? And I love that. I love that emphasis of sort of the way that those general aphorisms, Eroheb, I think that's a great way to talk about it, right? The aphorisms, those four aphorisms that are strung together there in the first half of the poem, are their application is shown, right? And the way that they get recalled, it's like, we sort of see how all of those principles come into play, right? With the crownless again being king. Good. For Thoughtless, the kings of Gondor do have crowns. There is a crown of Gondor. There's only the scepter in the north in Annúminas. There's a note. I'm forgetting. Where is the note? I think it's in Appendix A, isn't it? In Appendix A, when he's talking about the scepter of Annúminas, and he actually, Fourth Dauntless comes back to this poem and says, when he spoke of a crown, Bilbo was doubtless thinking of, you know, the Southern Kingdom, right? He was thinking of Gondor. Yeah, John, I thought that's where it was. And you can see the sort of later gloss on the poem to explain, like, despite the whole Scepter of Annúminas thing, the poem still totally works, right? Yeah, exactly, because he's thinking of the Southern Kingdom. Now, Matt, that's a really good question. Matt says, Bilbo says that he makes this for Aragorn after listening to him talk about himself. Is there a prophecy he's drawing on, or is Bilbo attempting to write a future into being? I think this is, well, it's not like Bilbo. I'm not sure either one perfectly applies. Like, on the one hand, Bilbo is, it's not like he's the first one to talk about this, right? It's not like he says like, hey, the crownless again shall be king. And everyone's like, oh, wow, really? You think? Like, so, I mean, you know, he's not going out on a prophetic limb here. Bilbo isn't. And yet, it's still bold, right? Aragorn is not quite so bold about himself as all this, right? Well, think this too. We'll be told in Rivendell that it's been told among the heirs of Elendil that the sword would be reforged when Isildur's bane returned, right? When it emerged again. And Bilbo is the ring bearer. Bilbo is the one who made that happen, right? So for him to then be the one who proclaims that it's coming, because the one thing, the crownless again shall be king, and Tony, I think that your point is well taken, that it's, you know, is this poem about Aragorn himself personally, or is it about the whole line of Isildur? If it's about Aragorn personally, it's a much bolder prophecy, right? That this is going to happen now in your time. But again, here, Bilbo could just be connecting two simple things. And again, it's not like he'd be the only one making this connection. Aragorn's obviously done it too, right? Saying, look, Aragorn tells me the sword isn't going to be reforged until the ring returns. I brought the ring, right? So since I can vouch for the fact that Isildur's bane is back, then I'm gonna say boldly that it's time for the sword to be reforged, and the one last step for the crownless again to be king. So Alex says, so Bilbo isn't a real prophet. He cheated. Well, it's not cheating exactly. Again, I don't think that Bilbo is like vouchsafed a vision from on high about what's going to happen in the future. He is writing this poem based on what he knows, based on what Aragorn has told him, based on what he's learned in Rivendell. Again, it's not like new information that people are going to be quoting the prophecy of Bilbo Baggins here. But these are still his words, and that's still important, I think. And of course, the way in which these things come true, this is a really good poem. This is a really good prediction, of Aragorn's, future here. I think that Bilbo definitely, I mean, we're getting way ahead of ourselves because this is months in advance, but, Bilbo says that he wrote it for the Dúnedain. He wrote it for Aragorn. And Aragorn seems to have taken it that way, as we'll see much sooner than a couple months from now. I think that Bilbo definitely intends this to be a prophecy about Aragorn personally. So, back then to the bigger context. Oh, okay, no, wait. One last note about the rhythm. I think it's really interesting. So, spoilers, we will be told that Bilbo composed this poem. And I think it's important that it's not in Hobbit meter. This is not like the drinking song. This is not like the walking song. This is not like the bath song. This is not even like, Bilbo's signature, the ring song, the setting out and the road goes ever on and on song. This is not even like that, right? This is a different song in a different context. This is not a Hobbit subject. This is a poem that he wrote for Aragorn. And I think it's important that he made it sound different. Valori, yeah, he's branching out poetically. This is a very different context from the other poems that he's written. Good. Okay. But back to the letter. We've not yet gotten to Bilbo talking about it or Aragorn quoting it. Gandalf has written it, right? Does he intend it to be able to be usable as a kind of a password, right? Because Aragorn will know this and some other random dude pretending to be Strider or calling himself Strider isn't going to know this poem. That would seem to work, but Gandalf doesn't give any instructions about that, right? And so the suggestion that I would make, or I forget now who it was who was suggesting it earlier. It may simply be that Gandalf has quoted this because he thinks it will help them to identify the real Strider, right? Make sure that it's the real Strider. There are many strange men on the roads. And then he tells him two things. A, his first name is Aragorn. B, without any explanation of why he's reciting it, the poem, right? JJ, exactly. It's not just a personal poem about Strider and his history and his future, right? It's also applicable to the situation. All that is gold does not glitter, not all those who wander are lost. Well, I don't know if it necessarily is just sort of written down as good advice, but it's hard to tell exactly what Gandalf's intention is here. Personally, I suspect that he means it as a way to identify Strider. He just is in too much in haste to give a full explanation, so he jots down the poem and then leaves it. Anyway, okay. PPPS. I hope Butterbur sends this promptly. A worthy man, but his memory is like a lumber room. Thing wanted, always buried. If he forgets, I shall roast him. Farewell. Now, I saw there was some earlier discussion about, like, why a lumber room in particular, and that's because, exactly as I think it was Matt was explaining, in a lumber room, like, the board that you need is always at the bottom of the piles, and if you leave something, you know, in the lumber, it's always going to get covered up by the new stuff that gets shoved in there, and that's, of course, exactly, Gandalf is here prophetic, right? About what's in fact going to happen. Remember when Butterbur's Butterbur explains his own response, right? He says that he told Gandalf, you know, I can send somebody tomorrow, maybe, or the next day. And Gandalf says, make it tomorrow, right? Because if you put it off, and the unspoken thing is because if you put it off to the next day, it's going to get buried in the lumber room of your brain, right? And let me just say, like, I totally sympathize with Butterbur here. I am exactly like that. Marianne says, is lumber room a UK word for attic? It's the same kind of concept, right? Like the place where you store stuff, where you put old stuff, and the thing that you want is always buried. Yeah, exactly. I think it's not just lumber. It's not only boards of wood that are kept in the lumber room. This is, so again, we see he's exactly right. This is exactly what's going to happen, right? If he forgets, I shall roast him. Farewell. I wonder, because he is in fact expecting or anticipating Butterbur's forgetting fairly accurately, if Butterbur has put in, or Butterbur, if Gandalf has put in this third postscript, because he does fear or foresee the likelihood of Butterbur forgetting, and has put this in as an explanation, right? If you do ever receive this, I want to make, you know, Butterbur was very forthcoming with his explanation, right? But if it had been delayed and Butterbur hadn't explained it or hadn't, been honest in his explanation or whatever, Gandalf's letter itself would contain an explanation of why it was that Frodo didn't get it. So now you might ask, well, so why does Gandalf trust his letter to Butterbur if he is as confident as this, with, of course, perfectly justified and fully borne out confidence, as we see in the forgetfulness of Butterbur? Why would he do it? Why would he send the letter anyway? Erokeb, yeah, says, who else could he leave it with? Exactly. He doesn't have any better options. Strider's not there. None of the other Dúnedain are around. He does feel that it would be best, as we talked about before, for him to go team up with Saruman and maybe stop the Black Riders where they are. But yeah, he doesn't have any better option. He's going to go, right? But he has no other choice but to send it with Butterbur. But he clearly has a kind of a sinking feeling, right, that it's not actually going to happen. Good. Oh, JJ was just looking it up. According to Wikipedia, it is very much like the attic, Marianne. The furniture, the pieces of furniture that are not in use are stored in a room that was called a lumber room. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, Tony, no, there wouldn't be any Shire hobbits around. There wouldn't be anybody going to the Shire. Again, Butterbur is the most likely person to have or to know somebody who is going to the Shire or could be sent to the Shire. Yeah, there wouldn't be any other hobbits that would be near enough for him to, again, without losing time, to go down and meet Saruman. Yeah. Yeah, good. Fourth Dauntless is saying, given the distance to Isengard, couldn't Gandalf have taken a day to ride to the borders of the Shire and post a letter within the Shire itself? Well, again, like, in retrospect, yeah, that'd have been better, right? Of course, in retrospect, he wouldn't even go to Isengard. But remember in the future, in the passage we haven't gotten to yet, when Gandalf is given the message, he's already late. Right, like Saruman wants him sooner, so he has no time. If he's going to answer Saruman's call and go join him, he doesn't have any time to mess around. And again, like in retrospect, he'd have done it differently, right? But no, he didn't think he even had those couple days to spare. Yeah. Okay. Cool. All right. Hey, we finished Gandalf's letter. Okay. Let's look at the reaction to the letter. Frodo read the letter to himself and then passed it to Pippin and Sam. "Really, old Butterbur has made a mess of things," he said. "He deserves roasting. If I had got this at once, we might all have been safe in Rivendell by now. But what can have happened to Gandalf? He writes as if he was going into great danger." "He has been doing that for many years," said Strider. Frodo turned and looked at him thoughtfully, wondering about Gandalf's second postscript. "Why didn't you tell me that you were Gandalf's friend at once?" he asked. "It would have saved time." "Would it? Would any of you have believed me till now?" said Strider. "I knew nothing of this letter. For all I knew, I had to persuade you to trust me without proofs, if I was to help you. In any case, I did not intend to tell you all about myself at once. I had to study you first, and make sure of you. The enemy has set traps for me before now. As soon as I had made up my mind, I was ready to tell you whatever you asked. But I must admit," he added, with a queer laugh, "that I hoped you would take me for my own sake. A hunted man sometimes wearies of distrust and longs for friendship. But there, I believe, my looks are against me." Yeah, oops. Seem to have accidentally timed out here. Okay. Yes, Strider, your looks are against you. So is the fact that you were acting like a rascal, right? So if what he wanted was for to be taken on trust, right? For him to be accepted for himself without proofs, he went himself a pretty strange way around to that, right? So this is a kind of an interesting personal appeal that Strider is making here at the end. And what I find most interesting about it is that it doesn't really seem to jive with the actual approach that he took, right? The way that he was acting was not like somebody who was hoping for the beginning that he would be accepted and could just find a friend, right? That like, I just want to be friends and I'm hoping you want to be friends with me. That is not how he was acting at the beginning. I think he says this, "I hope that you would take me for my own sake." A hunted man, like making that last statement, "A hunted man sometimes wearies of distrust and longs for friendship. But there, I believe, my looks are against me." Here, this is A, him acknowledging his cover story, right? The fact that he acts and looks rascally. But secondly, there's a kind of vulnerability here, which is a very different approach than he's had before, right? More than just, "I think it would be to your advantage to talk to me," right? "I would like a reward." This is a very, very different approach than he's taken before. Okay, let's see. Oh, and Mike, you are absolutely right. There would totally have been a lumber room in Bag End, right? Several of them, probably, with all of the madams that were there and with the hole being cleared out. It was the lumber room that would have been cleared out in part, right? Absolutely. But anyway, okay. Tony's asking if Sauron understood that the Rangers are the remnants of the Dúnedain of the North. Does he understand that? Yeah, okay. Well, first of all, how much current information does he have about what's going on up here in the north, right? How much interest has he taken? He does not know that an heir of Isildur still lives. So it is unknown to Sauron that is true. Now, how long has that been unknown? Is it just when Arathorn was killed and then his young son disappeared and has been raised in Rivendell under a false name for many years? Is that when he lost track of it? Did he lose track of it earlier than that? We don't really know, right? I mean, we know that he through his servant, the Witch King, was the opponent of Arnor, right, and was trying to bring it down. So we know that he's been involved in that, you know, from the beginning. But in the chieftain period of the Dúnedain, after the fall of the Northern Realm, did he know about the chieftain surviving? Did he know that there was still an heir of Isildur? I'm not really sure, right? I'm not really sure if, yeah, I don't know of any, I can't think off the top of my head of any very clear evidence about the degree of Sauron's knowledge as far, except for the fact that we know he thinks the line is extinct, because he's surprised to find the heir of Isildur when Aragorn presents himself. Anyway, so there's several things going on in that final speech of Strider's here. Let me take first, again, he's disagreeing with Frodo's statement. You know, if you had just told me you were Gandalf's friend, it would have saved time. And Strider's like, no, it wouldn't, right? You know, I didn't know that you had this letter that mentioned me, right? So, I mean, if I had said, oh, yeah, I'm Gandalf's friend, would you have believed that any more than you believed anything else I had said before? I mean, that's the first thing he says. But then, I did not intend to tell you all about myself at once. I had to study you first and make sure of you. The enemy has set traps for me before now. We've been talking about these lines already for a few weeks, thinking about his, thinking about this lying behind the conversation that he's been having, with them here. I'm still having a hard time. I mean, I get that conceptually, like in general terms, right? But what I'm having a harder time with is thinking about specifically, the enemy has set traps for me before now. How would this be, if this were a trap from the enemy, how would that be contrived, right? I'm not sure. I'm not sure I see that or understand. What was he afraid of exactly? We've talked about this a little bit before, but I don't know that we've solved this and I've forgotten it, or we never really solved it. What is Aragorn thinking might be happening here? Do you see what I mean? That these are fakes? That this is a fake Frodo? That they could be double agents. Exactly, Blue Wizard. That seems odd, right? I think, Tony, I don't think he could be thinking about years ago, because he's applying it to this situation. I had to make sure of you. The enemy set traps for me before, so by implication, that would seem that this might have been a trap, right? He wasn't about to tell everything about himself, to be open about himself right away. This is as much as to say, this is why I was doing my rascal thing at the beginning. I was playing up the role of Strider the Rascal, right? Because I was not sure about you, right? Now, to JJ, you're right. The Ringwraiths have been offering money for information. It's possible that they could have some hobbits traveling debris. They could be using hobbits, innocent hobbits, even potentially, not even necessarily collaborator hobbits, but they could pay hobbits to go to Bree and not fully understand why. That's possible. can imagine that. And we do know that they're offering money to people, to hobbits, right? Fourth Dauntless, I agree. Fourth Dauntless says he's curious why Sauron seems to target Aragorn directly, since we're told that Sauron doesn't know he's Isildur's heir. Yes, I agree. Presumably it wouldn't be Aragorn personally, because he doesn't know about Aragorn personally. But that it would be to, like, if there's a trap, the trap would be for anyone who was assisting, right? He knows that they know about the Rangers, right? Remember, we just talked earlier on, from Mariel's question, about the fact that, like, the Black Riders had to fight the Rangers, right? They drove the Rangers, or they scattered the Rangers at the borders of the Shire. So they know they're facing resistance. They might set traps. The Black Riders, might set traps in order to attempt to destroy those who are resisting them here, right? So he could just be targeting, you know, chieftain and leaders among the Dunedain. Yeah, exactly. It could be something like that, JJ. Yes, Fourth Dauntless, Aragorn does say that the enemy has set traps for him. But I think that we can read that as he has attempted, like, the enemy has set traps, which I, you know, caught on to myself before. Like, that is, I have been in the place of, I have been nearly caught by traps, or I have had traps laid. But again, I don't think that this is Sauron, setting personal traps for Aragorn, son of Arathorn. Because I don't think that he knows that he exists. It is possible, JJ, as you suggest, that he could know that he is a prominent and potentially dangerous ranger, that he is a leader among the rangers, that he wants to get rid of the ringleader of his opponents, but he doesn't really know who the ringleader is. He doesn't know that the ringleader is an heir of Isildur. That's also possible. That's also definitely possible. Maybe the Amazon series will clear all this up. Yeah, maybe. Maybe we'll see. I'm still puzzling over this, though. I go back to his phrasing here. I had to study you first and make sure of you. The enemy has set traps for me before now. I always linked those two sentences directly, right? Like, as if there were the word because in between them. I had to study you first and make sure of you because the enemy has set traps for me before now. But actually, that doesn't make any sense. This conversation, right? This conversation that they've been having in the room, which is what they seem to be both talking about here, right, has happened after Frodo has put on the ring in the common room, right? You have put your foot in it, Mr. Baggins, or shall I say your finger, right? He knows who he is, right? He just used the ring of power. He just turned invisible in public, right? He doesn't need to be told his proper name, right? He knows he's Frodo Baggins. He knows he's carrying the ring of power. There's only one invisible hobbit in the world, right? So by the time Aragorn comes in to have this whole conversation where he's posing as a rascal and everything, he knows this is the real Frodo Baggins. He has to. It has to be. He's got the ring of power, right? I can't think that what he means here is that I thought you might be a fake and I had to check you out, right? But you notice that's not what he actually says in that previous sentence. I had to study you first and make sure of you. Make sure of you. And we talked about that, saying that he's got to be wondering what's going on with Frodo, right? That he has to know who he's dealing with here. Yeah, Tony says maybe he's referring to his test of their courage from earlier. We were talking about this a little bit before, much earlier, right? With like, what is Strider thinking, right? What must Strider think of Frodo? How is he supposed to interpret the performance, right? Accident then, right? I wonder. Yeah. Eric Hebb says, maybe he's implying I needed to check if you would drag me under with you if I tried to help you. Yeah, something like that. Sizing them up for what they're facing or what they're about to face. That kind of thing, I'm thinking. I had to study you first and make sure of you, right? And again, that next sentence does seem to imply that, like, to make sure it was really Frodo Baggins that I'd been told to look out for. But again, he's confident about that still in the common room, Mr. Baggins, right? And the fact, Catriona, yes, that he saw them with Tom Bombadil also would surely have led him to suspect, to be fairly certain of who these people were. Now, that itself wouldn't absolutely prove it, but still. Yeah, Tony's wondering if maybe Frodo has gone over to the dark side due to possessing the ring. That's got to at least be an option, right? And, you know, Tony, to think that through a little bit more, remember what the ring has been tempting him to do. The ring has been very consistent in tempting Frodo to put on the ring and reveal it, right? The ring is trying to reveal itself. Frodo could be under its sway, at least to some extent, right? Alex, that's really interesting. Alex is paraphrasing those two sentences now as, I need to be sure you are ready for the traps we might be walking into. That is interesting, right, to think about that. I had to study you first and make sure of you. I mean, we talked about his options. He doesn't have very many good options here, right? But if this Frodo Baggins is either... You know, and that's interesting. Several people were objecting fairly violently to the idea that Aragorn would ever just take the ring from Frodo and bring it to Rivendell himself. I can think of one circumstance under which he would do that, right? And that's if Frodo were under the power of the ring. If the ring had gained dominion over Frodo with the Black Riders at hand, yeah, he'd have to, wouldn't he? I mean... He's not just going to fire Frodo for incompetence. That would be questionable, right? He can't do that. But he could, I think, if Frodo were not his own master anymore. If Frodo were clearly under the sway of the ring and the ring were leading him to reveal it to the Black Riders, as kind of was happening in the common room, he could think like, okay, like Frodo is not competent to continue at this point, and we're at a crisis moment here. If Frodo is not withholding the ring anymore, right? If he is not, if he has surrendered himself to the power of the ring, I gotta do something here. And so maybe that's one of the things that he needs to make sure of. Make sure. Tony, as you say, who's in charge, Frodo or the ring? That may well be what he was trying to make sure of here. Yes, Amethorn, I think that's a good way to say it, that he is being diplomatic about saying that he didn't initially trust them as companions and carriers of the ring. Right. Yeah. And I think this reading, the idea that the hobbits themselves might be a trap that the Black Riders have arranged for his benefit. That was always my reading of that passage. That's what I always thought it meant from when I was in high school. But the more I think about it, I think that that's wrong. I think that that makes much less sense than this, than what we were saying. Like, he is going to set traps. I've been through his traps before. He's tried to get me before. He is going to try to get us to get me. He's going to try double hard to get us now. Right. I have to study you and make sure of you can we go on? Can we move, you know, what do we have to do? Maybe he's going to just capture him like he did with Gollum, Tony. Yeah, that's possible. That's possible. Fourth Donald suggests that if Frodo was under the control of the ring, the thing to do would be to tie him up and carry him, not to seize the ring. We'll call this pulling a Gamgee. Maybe. Yeah, I mean, sure. But one way or the other, he's got to make up his mind what to do, right? But I'm not even sure. I mean, is that viable? Maybe. I mean, I guess he could probably, what is he going to do? Club Frodo into unconsciousness and carry the unconscious ring bearer bearing the ring over his shoulder all the way to Rivendell? It's possible. I mean, you know, physically he could probably handle that. But I'm not sure that that is a huge ethical step up from seizing the ring from Frodo. Yeah, and as Arrowhead points out, of course, he'd have to club Sam first. just what JJ was thinking too. Stick him in a sack. Yeah, exactly. Right. And then mince him up and boil him afterwards. Yeah. Hobbits and sacks aside, that whole reading to me of this passage makes much more sense than I had to make sure you were really who you were. Because again, he knows. He explicitly shows that he knows that in the common room. And that helps us to going back and thinking of the conversation that we've been having, our interpretations of his rascally behavior and stuff. He is testing to see their reactions and how are they going to respond. Are they serious? Is Frodo corrupt? Right? These are questions that Strider really needs to know. And then the third thing that he says, right? As soon as I had made up my mind, I was ready to tell you whatever you asked. As soon as I had made up my mind, again, not about their genuineness, made up my mind about what I was going to do with you, right? And the answer is help you on your way to Rivendell, right? That's obviously what he was hinting towards, leaning towards. It's plan A, right? It's always plan A. And how they responded to his rascally offer of help, or rather demand of reward, shows that he's already thinking in that direction, but is still sort of testing them. And then he makes the personal appeal at the end, right? Zephan, that's a really cool way of saying it. Zephan 12 is saying, it could be Strider saying, I wanted to make sure of you. The enemy has laid traps for me before and will likely lay traps before you, right? So, again, this is like, I had to make sure of you that you were kind of up to this, especially since, let's face it, he has not shown himself. Again, Frodo not covered himself with glory here so far. But then again, that sort of personal appeal show, like, I also, like, this is, I forget who said this earlier on, but this is, like, sort of not Strider the Ranger, not the persona. This is him dropping his persona, right, and talking as the person. This is, like, you know, the undercover cop dropping his cover story and admitting like what he would really wish for, right? Sort of acknowledging I have this persona that I'm trying to maintain, but you know, like underneath, I just want to be loved, right? A hunted man sometimes wearies of distrust and longs for friendship. It's not this persona that I've adopted isn't the easiest or most fun of all personae to adopt. Right. And that, I think, is an interesting sort of gesture of trust that he is that he's making to Frodo here. Cool. Well, it's getting late. Let's do one more. Whoop. Whoop. Sorry. Went too far. Okay. So he just said his looks were against him. Yeah, and Tony, I agree. Tony says, I always heard a hint of bitterness and loneliness in that statement about his looks being against him. Strider's persona costs him a lot. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. It's he's made a sacrifice for this, right? He really has. It costs him something to have to maintain this rascally persona all the time. At least all the time that he's around here interacting with people in Bree. They are, at first sight at any rate, laughed Pippin with sudden relief after reading Gandalf's letter. But handsome is as handsome does, as we say in the Shire, and I dare say we shall all look much the same after lying for days in hedges and ditches. It would take more than a few days, or weeks, or years of wandering in the wild to make you look like Strider, he answered. And you would die first, unless you are made of sterner stuff than you look to be. Okay, so Pippin has just tried to lighten the mood and been smacked down by Strider, right? Don't kid yourself. Yeah, exactly. Eric Hibbert's touching, right? How Pippin identifies days in ditches and hedges, which notice, by the way, that's it refers back to that same Pippin used almost the same phrase about hedges and ditches when Frodo wanted to make his shortcut across the Marish. Remember that, you know, I'll go through every hedge and ditch. Pippin thinks it's uncivilized, you know, not to just go by the road. Right. So clearly somebody who's been walking through the hedges and ditches for several days is going to, you know, everyone will look equally shabby, right? And here's Strider immediately cutting in and saying, you don't understand, right? Let me emphasize how much you don't understand what you're up against. If you think a couple of days going through hedges and ditches. Notice that, right? No, this is Pippin's idea of hardship. Cutting across land where there are hedges and ditches, that is to say, artificial barriers that have been imposed on livestock by civilized hobbits, right? That's what both hedges and ditches are used for, right? And it's inconvenient. It's very difficult to go through a hedge. It's very awkward to go across a big ditch, right? And you might get dirty and you might get a little scratched trying to do those things. You might even get very scratched. Who knows, right? But notice how he is, even in talking about hardship, he's still imagining civilized. He's not imagining the wild at all. There are no there's neither hedge nor ditch in the wild. That's the point. It's wild, right? He's not even imagining, he doesn't even have the category right in his head, right? Not to mention the fact that he thinks they're all going to be rugged veterans after a couple days doing this. So one of the reasons I think, therefore, that Strider kind of pulls him down here a little bit is that, and it's, he will not lighten the mood. He's just been talking about how I needed to test you, right? And now he's like, look, let us not make this mistake, right? Don't think this is not a hobbit walking party, right? You are not on holiday. And here I'm quoting, thinking of these quotes. Andy Higgins's talk at London Moot was about Tolkien's use of the image of holiday. And how the word holiday functions, the concept of holiday functions in Tolkien's writing. It was really cool, really interesting. Anyhow, but yeah, it shows that Pippin is still kind of thinking of this as a kind of holiday, right? This is still a hobbit walking party. This is something that they're kind of doing for fun. No, it's not like that, Pippin. Strider is really firm about that. Simon, I do think he's he's trying to crush Pippin a little bit. I'm sure Pippin does feel crushed. Here, Pippin was trying to be bright here, right? Yeah, exactly. Matt says there's something of the home by Christmas in this statement. So Matt talks about being home by Christmas, referring to World War One, right? How everyone thought it was going to be over quickly and they'd be home by Christmas. And nobody foresaw the long, drawn-out nightmare that the war was going to be. And there is something of that kind of... Pippin does kind of sound somewhat like a pre-World War One British lad, right? Who doesn't really know what lies ahead of him. I think that that's a really apt, a very relevant comparison there. Home by Yule, Alex. Exactly. And JJ, you're right. That's not like unique to World War One, right? That's very common. JJ is talking about how, you can see exactly the same kind of sentiment, exactly the same sort of mistake being made by both sides in the American Civil War. Yeah, no, it's quite frequent, right? Not having any, for those who have not been through that kind of experience, have no idea what really to expect, and what it's really going to look like. And this is applied not to war, but to the journey, the struggle that they have ahead of them in the wild, right? And you would die first unless you are made of sterner stuff than you look to be. This is, I think, to put, he's crushing Pippin, but not just, he's not just being a jerk, right? He needs them to, it is in Pippin's interest for him to understand. Not like, man, you need to, this is life or death here, my friend. Life or death. You don't fear these riders enough, he's already said. You don't fear the wild enough. Like, you could die. It will probably kill you. If you try to go through what I've been through, it almost certainly would kill you, right? So I think there's a kind of a challenge there, unless you are made of sterner stuff than you look to be. I don't think he's just insulting them. I think he's challenging him here, right? Prove me wrong. Show me how stern your stuff is, right? It is a little bit like a drill sergeant moment, Tony. And again, that really shows, like, no, this is not the time for pleasantries, Pippin, right? This is not the time for jokes. This is not the time for lighthearted banter. You need to really understand what's going on here. And a couple of you are pointing out how Strider is referring to himself in the third person here, right? And that's it, especially in the context, in this exact context, right? With the whole idea of Strider being a persona that he is adopting, and now through Gandalf's letter, something is being, like, his true identity is emerged. So now Strider is sort of more and more distant in a sense, right? Like, we're getting to who he really is. He is speaking. He was just speaking in a sense in his own voice, right? Behind the persona. And then we get him referring to that persona in the third person, right? You couldn't even adopt this persona, right, without spending days, weeks, years of wandering in the wild. Exactly. And Alex, you're right. Thinking about that beginning of the war idea, right? The person that they're talking to is somebody who has been, you know, in the trenches for years already. Pippin subsided, but Sam was not daunted, and he still eyed Strider dubiously. "How do we know you are the Strider that Gandalf speaks about?" he demanded. "You never mentioned Gandalf till this letter came out. You might be a play-acting spy, for all I can see, trying to get us to go with you. You might have done in the real Strider and took his clothes. What have you to say to that? I love Sam's theory that he did in the real Strider and took his clothes. But of course, Sam is exactly right. How Strider is acting right now would totally be how a good con artist would act, right? No, he didn't say anything about Gandalf before this letter came out. And Frodo was incautious, right? I mean, if we remember back to what Frodo just said, why didn't you tell me that you were Gandalf's friend at once? It would have saved time. So he just volunteered that. He reads the letter silently, so Aragorn doesn't know what it says. Though he has already overheard Butterbur saying that it was in his whole explanation about how it's a letter from Gandalf. What did Frodo reveal? He deserves roasting. So maybe you could get from that Gandalf threatened to roast him. If I had gotten this at once, we might all have been safe in Rivendell by now. He's revealed where... Well, now Aragorn already revealed that he knew about Rivendell, right? Just before Butterbur came in. What can have happened to Gandalf? And then again, why didn't you tell me you were Gandalf's friend at once? Implying that maybe that Gandalf mentioned him in the letter. So yeah, a good con artist would totally be able to use that, right? And be like, oh, well, you know, I had to check you out first. Now, Fourth Dauntless, I agree. They had kind of gotten past the whole you're a con artist thing before the letter came out. Sam is being stubborn. But it's perfectly rational, right? I mean, mostly perfectly rational. That you might have done in the real Strider and took his clothes is a little bit over the top, right? Butterbur clearly recognizes him as Strider, right? So, that doesn't actually make so very much sense. But one of the things that we certainly see about Sam here is his stubborn unwillingness to risk any harm. He doesn't... he doesn't want to take chances. Bruin here points out he might have done in the real Butterbur too. Ouch. Oh, ow. Okay. Yeah. Possible. Possible. Oh, okay. Yes. Can't rule that out. How would Sam know, right? Yeah. Can't prove it. Yeah. Erichhead points out that Sam had just heard the explicit instruction from Gandalf to be wary of men going by the name of Strider, and he took it to heart. Quite possible. That's interesting. Mad Violinist says, social immobility is a thing for Sam, and it seems to extend to the notion that folk don't change that much. Mad Violinist is thinking forward to the conflict between Sam and Gollum and how suspicious Sam will remain about Gollum. Is Sam more used to listening to and following instructions than the other three? Maybe. I don't think so, though. I don't think that this is a I'm following Gandalf's orders things. I think this is more of a, yeah, Tony, a not on my watch thing, right? Sam does not want to, he's not going to be daunted, right? Strider just smacked Pippin down, and Sam's not going to have any of it. Right, Sam is not going to be talked out of his suspicion. Remember, Strider had just said, you know, will you have him? And Sam says, I'd say no, right? I agree. Sam has trust issues, and he's justified for for having just trust issues. He's right not to have trust issues, or not to have trust issues, not to trust people. I don't think that Sam expects the fake Strider to buckle under his accusation and confess, Blue Wizard. I think he just wants to make him go away. He would rather have nothing to do with this guy. And remember, he's also suspicious of outsiders. At the end of the day, Strider's also a man, right? He's human. Big, intimidating, taller than usual, even for a human guy who looks dark and shady and rascally and comes out of the wild, and I never heard no good of such folk, right? He has a fund of traditional wisdom that has been handed to him about how you should not trust people like this. And so, yeah, better safe than sorry, right? And as Matt says, Sam has been told to watch over Frodo, right? To act the bodyguard by both Gildor and Gandalf. Yeah, he is taking his promise seriously, right? That he's not gonna he's gonna try not to let Frodo come to any harm. All right. Well, we will come back to we'll do Strider's response to Sam next time. See, not only did we do the poem, we got past the poem. We got like two whole slides past the poem. So there, that's good. I think we're going to stop there. It is long past time to go on our field trip here. I know I'm keeping everybody late here tonight. So we're gonna field trip it again now. Thank you, everybody, for joining us for a book discussion. I'm going to say bye to the Twitter folks and invite you guys to switch over and join us on Twitch, twitch.tv/signumu, if you would like to join us for the field trip today. So thanks to you guys.
Okay. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
Doing all right there.
I was thinking maybe you had done something technologically that was making you do that, but I have a feeling that's not it.
No, yeah, it was reaching up to my phone to touch the button. Oops.
Oops.
Oh, yeah. Okay, doing okay.
I did that while hitting a light switch today.
Yes. Western Angmar, yay!
Western Angmar, absolutely.
Huzzah, huzzah.
Okay.
So, just so you know, I looked it up. You were right. It was from the King of Morocco section.
King of Morocco, uh-huh.
From Merchant of Venice, not the Prince of
Aragon.
Prince
of Aragon was the silver, right? He was number two.
Yes, he was the silver casket, and I thought that the line was when he was justifying choosing the silver over the gold, but it was, in fact, it was actually a line by the king. It was in the scroll that he wrote inside the gold casket.
That he reads out. It's the scroll that's included in
there. I have the quote here if you want to hear it.
All that glisters is not gold. Hang on. All that glisters is not gold. Often has this something been told.
Have you heard that told?
Often have you heard that told. Every line rhymes with gold, but it never actually uses the word gold, right?
Many a man his life hath sold, but my outside to behold, gilded tombs do worms enfold.
Yes. Gilded
but it makes a good point. Gold. This is a phrase that is time out of memory. This phrase about gold being something that glitters is actually probably much older than Shakespeare.
Yes, all that glitters is not gold is quoted there. Yes, as a traditional saying even back then.
Yes, now the world's most overdone tattoo and bumper sticker.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Okay. All right.
So do our usual, write to go to Isildin and write from there?
I think so, yes.
I think it's our only route, really. Okay.
I mean, so, there's hunters in the group, and we could probably try to, you know, get fellowships and stuff together, but by the time we do
by the time we fill it up.
Yeah, all right, let's just take off then.
That's okay, cool. So I have two things.
Okay.
I have two things. One is a funny, and one is... serious that I was
no funny tonight, Trish.
So
that's okay.
So when you said the thing about, let's see, what was it? We were talking about Aragorn's making that comment about, you know, I had to be sure of you.
Yeah.
And you were like, well, what do you think What do we think he could have been? I was thinking Robo Hobbits.
Robo Hobbits. There you go.
Westworld.
Robo Hobbits.
Hobbits. You can't.
I think it was an excuse. That was just an excuse for him dropping the ball. He wasn't. Yeah.
My second thing was, I hadn't really thought. Well, I mean, you don't think of this, but I hadn't thought about the fact when he's talking about, you know, it's lonely out here, man.
Yeah.
Friends.
For a lone
and
cowboy.
He's like, what he doesn't say is, you don't know this, but I was Thorongil. I was a hero. I was a contender. You know, right. Like, from where I've come.
I made the Kessel Run, and then
I felt really bad for him.
Right. Right. Again,
yeah.
He has given up a lot, right? I mean, when you look back over it, I mean, it's not just, you know, quality time he could be spending with his girlfriend in Rivendell, but also, you know, and not even just, you know, that like his people that he separates himself from and doesn't see that often. I mean, everything. How many times he has, like, you know, he spent his whole life walking away from
everything.
Everything. Yeah. Yeah. He's been doing that ever since he found out who he was.
But at the same time, if they had accepted him without question, he would have just been there telling them how stupid they were.
Right. Well, exactly. Exactly. And that's, again, why I tend to think that that last comment about longing for friendship isn't an actual attempt to explain his actions. Right?
I think he's trying to be endearing, yeah.
Right. Kind of after the fact to say,
no, I was
going to
say, after the horse has left the barn.
Yeah, exactly.
Do it
right
now, dude.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, or are you, I mean, I guess you could say it's not totally after the fact because he's still trying to build, you know, some kind of rapport with them, but he's taking a new tack at it. Right.
We've established that the hobbits
wouldn't guess the guy is going to be a king, by the way.
Certainly
right.
Not
in this scene.
Yeah. And some, there was some sting in that of the whole, you know, not everyone tells me to leave and make sure I haven't left any marks on the chair, you know?
Right. Well, Butterbur clearly does.
The hobbits have proven to make decisions emotionally and not rationally. I think at this point he's appealing to them in an emotional way instead of a logical way.
Right. And again, as a person, as an individual, not as, you know, king or even, you know, he's not talking about his qualifications as a guide or anything like that, as he was before. That was the appeal he was making, you know, when he said, you know, Strider can take you by paths that are seldom trod. Will you have him?
He sounds like Gollum when he says that.
When he speaks of himself in the third person?
Yeah, that's the only other guide we know, and he also speaks in third person. It's like they've both got these personas, you know, but they've convinced themselves this is their role or something.
Yeah.
It's just weird. It's just weird that our two learned guides like to refer to themselves by their stage name.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about that connection with the two of them. Let's see. I mean, it is kind of funny that it's the two guides there. It doesn't seem like anything intrinsic to the role of guide necessarily, but
but they're both people Frodo has to trust implicitly.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and it's not like Strider does it all the time.
No, he drops it pretty fast once they're out in the wild, I think, doesn't he?
Yeah, well, I mean, even in this conversation, he's been using the first person most of the time.
Yeah.
I mean, very notably, when he's talking about his own persona, right? I do have rather a rascally look to me. You know?
He sounds... I always imagine he's proud of himself when he says that, just like John Hurt did in the animation.
Yeah.
He said that with pride.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to think of the effect of the third person usage. Like, I mean, I know it strikes us as kind of strange, and that people who talk about themselves in the third person.
Like, it's a dissociation.
Yeah, and it normally
a rapper.
Well, see, that's it, right? I mean, like, why do they, you know, why is that a thing, you know, among rappers, for instance? I mean, one of the things that...
Well, because kings do it. Kings return themselves in third person.
Yes. Well, exactly, right? There is a dissociation, right? Like a distancing mm-hmm. of yourself from yourself. Mm-hmm. But normally it's for the sake of admiration, of self-admiration, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I am a big deal, and so, you know, like, I observe myself from the outside and, you know, observe what a big deal I am seems to be the, you know, the implication. So, I mean, because it seems to be an arrogant move. At least we tend to interpret it as arrogant.
Yeah, I'm starting to see why, I'm starting to see why Arwen turned him down the first time.
Well, but that's the thing, though. With taking those two examples, Strider and Gollum, right? What do we see there? That's how we think of it, but I'm not sure that that is how they would have associated it. I'm not sure that that's native, you know, to the text or to this sort of area here, chronologically and geographically speaking. With Sméagol, he talks about himself in the third person, but he also talks to himself all the time. And so that sense of dissociation with Gollum is far more profound, right? I mean, he's speaking, about himself, but he always also speaks to himself. Strider doesn't speak to himself.
Yes.
So we don't have that same kind of, you know, I'm probably a little unhinged kind of dissociation that we get with Gollum.
He's been in the wild a long time. I don't know.
Well, yeah, but we never see it. So,
do we know if he talks to himself? I talk to myself when I'm alone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Anyway, okay. West Angmar, we should probably get back on track.
Yeah, we should get back on track. I'm just trying to think of... But the question I'm trying to answer is, what is the effect? What effect is he going for? What effect does he think he's going to have? Because he's obviously transitioning into that, right?
Mm-hmm.
He doesn't just use it compulsively.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I would think he'd be using it purposefully, but for what purpose?
For what exactly? What is the purpose? Because I'm not convinced that it has the same associations in the text that we have with it when we hear a modern contemporary person do it.
Right. Yeah,
I agree.
Oh, Trish, we're getting some things in chat that you're a little hard to hear.
Not sure what to do about that. I'll yell.
Yell, yeah, there you go. That's good. So I think we're mostly here.
Yep.
Mostly here?
Like
okay.
It.
All right. So today we're gonna leave the village of Al-Khair, if that's how we pronounce it.
really?
Let's not start that again.
Sure? Don't be hasty here now.
Okay,
sure
I know. We'll give it a shot. We're gonna go. Okay, here we go.
You have to go through the pig pen.
Cutting through the pig pen.
I just ran to someone's house.
It was probably the guy with the roving threats, sitting there giving him roving threats.
Yep. Serves him right.
Okay. So let us look about ourselves here. All right. What do we see? So we saw this big old wall on the hill, right?
Mm-hmm.
And now we look out into this valley and we can see a land that was once wooded and it was not dense forest, right? The trees are not densely packed together, but looking maybe kind of like the Green Hill country in the Shire, perhaps, you know, with like occasional stands of trees and rolling hills and grass.
Mm-hmm. Kind of looks like Farnos now.
Yeah, it does look like Farnos. The trees look like
white
Farnos.
Light.
Except remember in Farnos we saw that the trees had life on them, right? They
mm-hmm.
were sprouting leaves. These are not sprouting leaves. This is just dead. Now we see there's a ruin up there. The style of those walls and towers is just like the ones on top, as I recall. Yep. Yes, it is. Whoever made that fortress up on that hill was the same as the one who made the one on the hills behind us. And then more out here. Look at all these. We've got fortifications upon fortifications. I keep turning my camera accidentally. Backing up, going up to higher altitude to see over the trees again. Look at all those.
Yeah.
Is that a zigzaggy wall, or are those lots of multiple towers?
It is kind of zigzaggy. I'm not sure what it was supposed to be.
So we're looking at these over here, and this up here, I think, is the big keep that we're seeing, and these areas. So if the original wall was down here, I'm looking at the map now. If the original wall was down behind us here, blocking this pass, then perhaps what we're seeing, because then we have this valley, which again would have been a nice, rich, lush valley and hill region. But then we have this secondary wall of mountains. Or at least of large hills up there ahead of us, which also seems to have been defended. The one straight in front of us right now, when we're standing on the road, the biggest one that we can see as soon as we come over the rise, looks like an actual city rather than merely a wall or sort of isolated fortifications. All right. Well, let's look around a little bit. What are these? Are these just lumpy rocks? What are these like? Yeah. They look like stalagmites.
Yeah, they do.
In the open, which is a little bit weird.
Yeah, those are natural rock formations.
Yeah. It's weird. Mm-hmm. Strange rocks. And this all looks like it was maybe once a lake?
Yeah, something that's dried out a long time ago. Yeah. We see a couple of these around here.
Yeah. Which is interesting, right? So you can see it's not just that the grass and trees have all been blasted and killed over time. It's Grimgor. Good old Grimgor.
Yeah, the one pig in this area.
Yeah. But you can see that, you know, they're larger. So we've got this pitiful, unhealthy-looking last remnant of water in what was probably a large lake, it seems like, just based on the topography around here, looks like that.
Mm-hmm.
So that, you know, we've been talking about how in various broadcasts we've been talking about the whole desolation surrounding evil and everything. We can see this is a fairly advanced in the blasting. Now, these creatures that are being shot down all around us, we have wargs, right? Mm-hmm. Which is not surprising. We have Grimgor, our one huge boar that we just passed. And we have...
He's an anomaly, though.
Yeah, he's an anomaly. What were those other creatures?
Hill beasts. Big red yeti.
Right. So they're...
And they have their habitat near the dried out lake.
Right. Okay. So these are like ape creatures? Ish.
I suppose that's as good a descriptor as any, I suppose.
Ape-ish. What are those? What are those spiky things?
Spiky things? Oh, those are ruins.
Let's go. Those are an interesting looking. Okay, so here we got a bit of wall.
Cliff.
We got a cliff. Cliff go all the way around? No. Oh, hang on.
No.
I should face my camera in the same direction that I'm looking. That would be good. Yeah. Oh, we've seen something like this before.
Was it near the entrance in Estelden?
Yeah, I think it was like in the past, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think so. It wasn't broken like this, was it?
Were these all together before? Was this an arch once? It's broken
off?
Yeah,
I think it was a big metal arch or something. Like a big dome? Yeah.
It's been broken.
Archway.
Down.
It'd be huge, though. Look at this. This is like cyclopean nonsense here.
Yeah, and this would be huge.
What are they housing in this area?
Though that's what it looks like. Though all of the pillars have all been broken off at the same, in the same place. Which, I mean, these looked like the needles of, you know, sundials or something.
Oh! It's it would be a vaulted thing over here with these four here, like a vaulted ceiling.
Right. So like we'd be from here, we'd be like right in the middle of the dome, right?
Yeah.
And these are not so far apart that those could make a dome if you connected them all. They're not perfectly arranged. And
no,
we don't get any hints, right? There's no carvings, no iconography anywhere.
Nope, it's just kind of scuzzy.
Yeah, no, just the stone, which matches all the other stonework that we've seen.
The tall spire looks a bit like Narsil.
Heh. That's interesting. So are we meant... These structures, are they evil structures? Are these ruins the ruins of evil buildings? That is to say, are we looking at the ruins of fortifications built by the followers of the Witch King in ancient days? Or is this repurposed? I can't imagine it's Dunedain construction way up here, and we certainly see no evidence that it was. You'd think there'd be some stars somewhere remaining.
Yeah. Oh, Durston posted, and it's funny, I noticed the same thing just as you posted it, Durston, that all the structures are facing out, and they have those little extra arches on the side. It makes them look like flying buttresses.
Hmm.
It does indicate sort of a technology lost. We don't see a lot of, domed ceilings or anything like that,
in any of the modern buildings.
In any of the other ones. So maybe this predates some of this architecture, because it is hinting at a more artistic flair design,
someone with
a better grasp of architecture. Yeah,
perhaps.
You can see it here. It's actually pretty well spaced out over here.
Yeah, here, I'm looking at this dark boundary up here to see if there's anything carved on it, but I don't see anything.
Nothing. Well, it's got these horrible iron oxide looking things
exactly.
on the top.
It's the iron bits that I was looking at.
Yeah.
Did you guys talk about this triangular stone when you were down there? It looks like something from Orthanc.
Triangular?
What, the big spiky thing?
Yeah, the big spiky thing.
Yeah. We're looking at
the big spiky thing.
Yeah.
It's one of
it looks like
Orthanc like all the other stalagmites kind of looking thing. Well, it's probably just indicates it's made out of a type of stone that didn't wear away like everything else did.
Maybe. Though, I don't know, with all of them, and so those four down there that we were looking at look like they could be the broken off bits of a dome, but hang on, can it drop off the cliff? Okay, I did fine. But like this one here, this is obviously not anything to do with a dome because it's overlooking a cliff here.
Yeah.
So what is this? Is it in fact broken off, or is that how it was meant to look? It looks intentional and they're all broken off in the same place.
Yeah. The way the vaults are situating, it'd be supporting something down that cliff or something like that.
Yeah. Which is a little hard to believe. I mean, maybe.
Yeah, it is.
Again, maybe those four. See, those are the four that we were looking at down there. Those four.
Maybe.
Again, they could have been supporting a dome. But, I don't know.
Yeah, maybe there was some rock past this part that fell over in a landslide.
Maybe.
It looks like a big riverbed down here. That's the thing I don't quite understand, because where the four arches are standing, it'd be right near where those lakes dried up.
That could have been an island, though, you see, on that rise where those four things
yeah,
are.
Yeah, yeah.
That could be. It could have been an island in the lake or river that was here.
Giant gazebo on the island. So maybe maybe we're looking at a river that has expanded its bed since these things were built, and then before drying
then
up
dried
completely.
Out. Yeah. Maybe. Ooh, well, that's interesting.
Well, it does kind of look like that, because you know the swamp is just over the hill over there too.
Right.
Mm-hmm, this would have been a river.
Right.
Could have been some kind of a keep or something.
Oh, yeah. That whole swamp could even be like an oxbow lake or something.
Right. Exactly. So the river would be flowing from the west into the east and ending in the swamp, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah.
It is amazing.
It still could be. You know, maybe
much...
it's a flash flood channel. You know?
Right.
Big rains in Angmar thing could turn into, you know, flash flood.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I'm sure they have plenty of flash floods at the amount of scrub
the
they got here.
Rains down in A.
My kids are singing that nonstop now. Help me.
Now, okay, so file a crow here. This is... Okay, we get this serpent sign, which we've seen, the dragon slash serpent sign, which we've seen on shields up in Alkire, and it's on banners down here.
Yep.
And then you got these skulls. So now here's the Iron Crown. Here we got the Iron Crown on a banner with skulls and stuff. Right, so fine. The same kind of half moon symbol that we saw, you know, on the chieftain's hat and on the standards in Alkire. So you can see the connection here. Though we clearly have this, you know, the tribe that's gone over to Angmar. But again, here, what I want to point to is the symbol on the banner. And we're not seeing that symbol anywhere, even in the North Downs, for instance. We haven't seen any ruins that don't have something. Either they had, you know, Arthedain or Rudaur. Now, that was obviously, the North Downs is a much more thoroughly Dunedain-focused area than this is, obviously. But my point is, like, even the bad guy stuff had symbols. And we've seen, you know, bad guy symbols before. I don't know. Mm-hmm. I'm just surprised there's nothing in the stonework.
Yeah.
If this was made in the time of the Witch King, I mean, surely the symbols of the Witch King would be etched somewhere, right?
That's true.
At least you'd think.
Some point in future, we're going to have to compare it to Carn Doom and give it a good combing over.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I'm kind of doing here is establishing the baseline, you know?
Yeah.
The thing that's most characteristic about these ruins is that ironwork around the top that we were looking at. And that we can see that's what gives these towers that characteristic, you know, makes them kind of look like Duplo block towers, you know, stacked up in the distance there.
But with Gothic accessories.
Yeah, a little bit more dark than Duplo blocks, admittedly, but...
the tent also has this fun sort of orange segment on it.
Wait, there's a fun... I missed the fun orange segment. What's the fun orange segment?
On top of the tent here. It looks like all the little metal things that they have for accessories.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Yep, the little, those whole...
Yeah, those little metal dealies.
Yeah.
You can see it here on the skull.
Yeah, exactly.
I was just going to say, and of course we have the usual skull decorations.
Yeah, skull decorations, which is pretty much of a giveaway, right?
Yeah, I mean, between the, you know, pelvis fireplaces and Goblin Town.
The pelvis
skull,
fires in Goblin Town, absolutely. Oh, man. The pelvis fires just don't get old.
Nope.
Yeah, so Catriona, exactly. I would expect to see the Iron Crown carved places, and even if it weren't, this is clearly not Rudauran. I mean, we know the Rudaurans were allied with Angmar, but they had the Numenorean star all over the place.
Or the perverted star.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where did Narnian go?
Oh, sorry. We're up by the encampment up here.
Oh, yeah. Well, so am I. I just don't see you. Sorry. I was going to ask you if you actually planned... Oh, there you are. Plan to go in there? Are you actually planning to go in there?
Yeah, I was planning to go in here.
Okay. We should probably go on foot then for...
Right. Yeah, we got the stone. Obvious right reasons. It's not going to kill us. It's just going to give us dread.
Okay. Okay, because this is a hillman fort, and...
Uh-huh.
Okay, and we've got one of these things. Where have we seen these?
By the big watching stones, was it?
And were they on the way up on that trail up to Angmar that we
saw? Yeah,
yes. A few months ago.
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Is that a face up there on the top?
It's funny, it almost looks like a lotus, you know? I mean, it looks a little bit more enlightened than, you know, you would expect.
Yeah, a bit elven
for these guys.
Exactly, yeah, yes, yeah, it does it look elvish. It doesn't look very evil.
Or hillmanish, even.
Or hillmanish, no. It looks kind of like a spearhead, but it also looks kind of like the ship symbol. And it's not the ship symbol of the Numenoreans that we see in Evendim, but the shape of it reminds me of that, vaguely.
So it reminds me of some leaves of Lorien stuff we're going to see later on in later worlds.
Yeah, it does.
And it doesn't look like it's been shaped by crude tools of hillmen or fashioned by mad artists inspired by eldritch gods like the Watching Stone.
Like the
right
Watching Stones, yes, exactly. Nor does it look to be made of the same stone.
No. It's almost a metallic.
Yeah, it does almost look like bronze or something.
This is probably some deep magic.
Yeah, I don't really get that. And then here's a Watching Stone, which is very similar.
Very eldritch.
To the other one, though not identical to the other statue.
Yeah, this one's got little dealy horns instead of the more alien-looking head.
Oh, it's got its mouth open. Yeah, the horns sticking forward give it a different kind of look. Still clearly the same species, however.
Dreadful in its goofiness.
Right, and then we've got the two banners. And this is the banner, then, of the hillmen who serve the Iron Crown?
Yes, this is a hill... Yeah, this is both a hillman site and an Angmarm sorcerer site here.
Right. More of that same rock, is it?
It's quite cool.
Right. Right.
Other side, we get to see the evil rites going on.
Yeah, exactly. Not something you'd want to lean your back against and have a picnic, necessarily.
Well, the hobbits would do it anyway, though.
Yeah, they probably would. They probably would. Now, obviously, the palisade, the wooden palisade, is a late construction, obviously, presumably by the hillmen, who are fortifying this place, which looks like, given the fact that this wall is broken off, and we have those towers over there, you got to imagine there was a curtain wall down here where the palisade was. And
is that a design in the iron, those three iron things?
Up on top?
Yeah. Let me change my graphics. There is. It's a design. It looks a lot like that elven-looking evil rock. Looks like three leaves or something. I can't get
is
much
it a
clearer
head?
That. It looks a bit like knotwork.
Yeah.
It looks abstract in origin. Still, that's the closest thing we've seen to some sort of design on these.
It is.
Reminds me a bit of those ivy leaves we see all over the Rudauran buildings.
Yeah.
That is interesting.
That is.
Well, there we go. There's the first spark of artistic flair.
Of something, yes, exactly. And it looks like, was there a wall across this? Maybe. A little hard to tell. This, whatever it was, you know, this fortress is so beat up. There's not enough left down here to really piece it together. But we've seen things like that in...
filthy and moth-eaten over here.
Yeah. Yeah, we've seen things like that in Fornost as well. Okay, now here we have the Angrim Sorcerer's ritual.
Nobody killed them yet. Nobody killed them yet. We're going to... Oh. Never mind.
That's okay. We got them.
That's all right. I got them. Hey, I got a steel token out of it.
Okay, then he's going to deal with them.
Yeah.
And then we've got the spirit is freed with the death of the sorcerer.
He's going to go after the...
Oh, okay. Apparently.
If he was left to his own devices, he would have actually attacked the Duvardine.
Right.
He does. I was actually up here one time on level, and I saw some guys running around the corner. I thought they were players, you know, and they were running away from this fell spirit, so I went to help. They were Duvardine.
Okay, so he actually...
And
he,
then they
he goes
all
after
came
the
and fought me. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, you go.
Right, yes, and then they forget their differences as soon as...
and then they came after me, right.
Yeah.
Of course. Yeah, that was totally that you don't have enough badges to control me kind of moment.
Right. Okay, so this statue...
Why they put a picnic blanket out there?
Well, and this one is screaming. The other one out in front was not leaning forward and screaming like this.
Bent over like that.
Yeah, like he's in the middle of shrieking.
R-E-S-P-A-C-T!
I don't think that's what he's shrieking. But, okay, so that's interesting. So he is active, whereas like he's in mid-action, where the others were just standing there.
Mm-hmm. And notice we don't have a dread thing now that the spirit's dead.
Right. Okay, so at the base of this spirit, the ritual was being performed to enslave that spirit?
Put it into a stone for the watching wardens.
Yeah. Because they're beating on the... they're beating on the halfling. Okay. Please don't let them interfere. I shall deal with you. All right, now he's going to deal with us and be swiftly dealt with himself, and then the spirit's going to be free, and there aren't any Duvardine to attack, so he's going to go after somebody else. Right. But he was a fell spirit who was not free. He was being enslaved.
Well, he was being enslaved. He was doing before then, I don't know.
He was in the enslavement process.
Yes. Okay. Whether he was free before then or in some sort of phantom zone, who knows.
And it was an Angrim sorcerer with the Hillmen as his guards.
For most people, this is their first Angmarum kill in this area.
Right. Right. And we had two more of those spearhead... I think that must be an Angmarim symbol, then. This. If it's the way that they're set up around this...
Unless they were instructed by the Angmarim to do so.
Yeah. No, I'm just thinking those spiky stone things. These...
It doesn't look like anything else we've seen in the Duvardine camps, though.
Well, not in Alkyr, but... That's why I think this must be a... Those must be Angmarim things.
No.
Yeah, I agree.
Then we get it up here, too.
Yeah, it's too elegant looking.
Right, it doesn't fit with the rest of the Hillman stuff.
Yeah, most of their stuff's worked in bronze or stone.
Right.
And not even like work stone. A lot of it's just rough stone.
Even their weaponry is not as impressive as the weaponry of the... Okay, this is similar shields and stuff. So yeah, we can see the sort of the connectedness of these clans, right?
Uh-huh.
This clan that serves Angmar with the clan that does not...
And, did you notice that this palisade is actually built against ruins?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're clearly using the ruins. And up here, it's a little easier to put together where the ruins were, we can see that was a gateway.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And now, but they've extended it because the wall, you know, the curtain wall over here broke down.
There's a bit of patching to do.
Yeah. Another Angmarim stone. And then another layer, and this was a, would have been an excellent, you know, sort of concentric fortification continuing to go up and in.
Right.
And now this looks like the central keep here. Is there a gate behind it, or is this just a big courtyard?
I don't think I've ever been up here before.
I don't think I had either.
I don't think anything sends us up here, does it?
I don't think so. I'm pretty sure it's why I never have been.
Yeah, no, you would. Yeah, you would know for it. You're
I would know exactly.
Completionist.
Exactly.
I think this is just if you want to complete the Slayer deed.
Yeah, I have one page left. One of these guys might have, so I'm killing as many as I can find.
I'm now thinking about how many times I circled around that old camp trying to get more information.
No,
I could have just
no way
gone
to get
up here.
That hill.
And there's another one of those spiky things right next to the wall. And here it does look very buttress-like, but the spiky thing on top sticks up above the wall. I mean, that seems totally irrelevant.
Yeah, and that extra, that little arch means it's supporting the wall in the other direction. Like, this is, we're outside the wall.
Right.
That it's supposed to be going in.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and see, there's another one there. And this looks like a gateway to an inner keep, but there's no gate in that wall behind the tent.
No.
By that, I am puzzled. Maybe it got bricked up. I don't know.
That's what I'm thinking. It got bricked up. That's what it looks
got
like.
Got bricked up.
There's a groove.
There's some guy
here,
behind there asking for a Monteado.
It looks like a gate of some kind. There's two grooves.
Right.
Two big grooves here.
No, I got to investigate now. Yes, it looks like at some point there was something here. These metal
tracks.
This
is where I was expecting it.
Yeah.
Oh, this is where the elevator was.
Right. Yeah, so this central section, well, it doesn't look any newer than the rest of it.
Drawbridge?
Wow.
Ladders, maybe. Maybe this was ladders to get up to the archery gallery.
Maybe.
Which would have been made out of wood so they'd rot away.
I don't know.
Do you think we're putting more thought into this than the devs did?
Oh, well, that hardly matters.
That's true. That's true.
I'd like to think they
put a lot. I shouldn't even have said that.
Let's see. I'm just looking at that. Oh, I just noticed that the shield stand is made up of spears bound together. That's interesting.
Everything's made of spears. The tent poles are made of spears.
Oh, right, because they stick out up at the top, yeah.
Yep.
Really long.
It's like they're
spires.
Trying to put holes in stuff.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, you're right. I see all the spears over here. Oh, what's with this chest?
Nah, it's probably just got junk
just
in
a
it.
Chest.
Yeah. Well, if you're level 45 or something, go ahead.
Right. And a big old bonfire in the middle of camp. Okay. Mm-hmm. The sky is really interesting up here.
I know. It's like especially, electronic discharge or something.
Yeah, and especially around with the sun up. It's kind of like perverted northern lights, except it's daytime.
Yeah, like some sort of force fields over everything.
Yeah.
The designs look like rippling water.
Yeah, they do. Huh.
Yeah, I love when it just goes zit like that and you see everything. At nighttime, it's even more fun because it's green.
Yes.
But yeah, you can see where the sun's supposed to be, but we're just not getting any of it, which explains why everything's dead here.
Okay, we're now looking back this toward from this vantage point. It's a good vantage point to look back where we came to. That's the slope to Alkire up over there, I believe.
Uh-huh.
Yep, because there's that big, huge curtain wall up above where Alkyr is. So that's the gap to Alkyr that we're looking at down there.
Mm-hmm.
So this looks like it was a big fortification. We still haven't really seen any images, any pictures, and we've seen banners, but no carvings.
And homes, no homes other than just the mobile stuff. This is just
right.
Things to protect other things.
Exactly, yeah. We haven't seen any cities. So again, in trying to reconstruct what Angmar would have looked like, we're not getting too far yet. Other than just fortifications, continually layer upon layer of fortification.
Which is what you get when you're a massive power and nobody likes you.
Right, I guess. Maybe everybody lives on the inside.
Well, it's clear to see that the Witch King didn't fear, you know, had feared somebody.
Yes.
Or he wouldn't have bothered with this much.
Yes. Feared somebody from the south, right? It's clearly Arnor.
Yes.
That this is oriented towards all this stuff. Mm-hmm. From the pass of, you know, from Alkyr on. Now that would be Carn Doom. Yes. Up on the mountain. That's Carn Doom.
Yep. Oh.
We have to go there, you know.
Yes, we do.
Yeah, we do. Hopefully on Landreval.
Yeah, I think we have to make it a Landreval.
I think we might.
Tonight.
Okay, so next we will go up to these two other cities whose names I forget.
Fashfalhoid?
Yeah.
Imhad Belkor?
Yeah. Oh gosh, I've kept everybody up really late tonight. I should let everybody go. But yeah, well, it's just that my last observation here is that Carn Doom up on the mountaintop there looks very similar in its stone and construction to the city that's down in the valley here.
Yep.
So we will start with those cities in the valley. Then I'm going to want to loop back around. We're obviously not going to get to Carn Doom from here. We've got to loop all the way around. But I want to go over
the Watching Stones.
Exactly. So I want to look at these two towns, and then I want to come back around and look at this orc hold down here.
All right.
Then after we finish that, we'll get into Malenhad and then maybe as far as the Watchstones, which I'm kind of trying to put off, but eventually we will have to cross them. All right.
Yes, we will. That's book one.
You held up pretty well for being an injured dude.
Thank you. Yes, and a couple.
I applaud you.
Near moments there, but we did all right. Mm. Thank you, everybody, for
Strider
joining us.
Strider would approve you to go
Thank
with the fellowship.
That's good.
Yes.
Thank you. Yes, yeah, clearly made of stern stuff. You can tell by
yes.
how boldly I sat here and talked for several hours on end.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Just like Outrond.
Exactly. Sitting and talking for several hours on end. That's true. That's true. All right. Well, thank you, everybody. And I will see you guys next week. We have a nice little stretch here in May where, as far as I know, barring further injury, I should be able to be here every week for the rest of May. So,
all right.
I'll see you guys
awesome.
Next week. Thanks, everybody.
Bye.
Bye. Thanks for joining me on this epic exploration of the Lord of the Rings and of Standing Stone's video adaptation of Tolkien's story. If you are having even half the fun I'm having on this journey, I hope you will consider supporting the project by donating at signumuniversity.org/fund.